From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Welcome to Soundings. Literature and culture, those are the topics this week on Soundings. My guests are two scholars from Duke University, Frederick Jameson and Stanley Fish. Duke University was the site of a recent conference entitled Convergence in Crisis, Narratives of the History of Theory. Stanley Fish and Fred Jameson of Duke University, you have just staged a conference with an intriguing title, Convergence in Crisis. Fred, let me begin with you. Why is that title important? What does it tell us about literary theory and criticism today?
Well, it suggests that some of the problems that we have faced in specialized ways in literary and cultural studies are shared by a whole range of other disciplines which face similar crises in the specific languages and specialized codes of their fields, too. And one of the ideas of the conference was to compare notes as to where these, as to where the state of the art was in each of these disciplines.
Stanley Fish, why is the word crisis important here? Are we exaggerating for the sake of effect? Tell me about that.
Well, I think that the word crisis could be an exaggeration, and I think it is when it's used by some people to indicate general crises in the humanities. But I think the word crisis converges on us at this moment precisely because of the recent, by recent I mean last 15, 20 years, emergence of theory and theoretical discourse in the academy as a primary focus of attention.
Theory in contrast to what? How, for example, do we differ with literary, looking at literature, say, 25, 30, 50 years ago?
Well, I think that is the crucial question, and the easiest way to answer it is to say that 20, 25 years ago, which is within both Fred and my professional lifetimes, one performed certain routines when doing literary criticism, explicated poems, talked about themes, identified genres.
Conducted hunts for symbols.
That's true. What one didn't do is look at the underlying principles which made what we did seem obligatory and routine possible. And I should say that although many definitions of theory and theoretical activity are available, that that's one helpful one, to look at the underlying principles of a discipline or a practice. Those principles which, while not at any one moment visible, are nevertheless constraining and ruling the entire field. And since they are not visible, they're doing work of which members of the profession and those who attend to the profession are not always aware. So one part of the theoretical movement has been to bring to awareness those constitutive ways of thinking that in a sense, license what we do. What we have been learning in the last 25 years is that the divisions between those studies, rather than being obvious or natural, that is, came down with the stars and the trees and the leaves, are themselves historical and, in some important sense, political achievements, so that the simplicities we see, since they are constructed simplicities, are the product of very complex and attenuated forces.
Stanley Fish uses the word political, and I understand that that can be an important consideration. Let me take you in that direction for just a moment, Fred Jameson. How is language and literature, how are they political today? Is that a concern that you were looking at in this conference?
Yes, among other things. I wouldn't imply that they are more political today than they were, right, but rather that our study of them has come to be aware of the political dimensions of all of culture. And in a sense, we are still reacting against the much more limited criticism of the new criticism, for example, and of schools of literary study that were very intent on isolating literature as an aesthetic experience and separating it out from the rest of society. That I think may have been very important to do it at one moment. But today, what strikes us is the way in which literature and culture in general have resonances on all the levels of society, very much including all kinds of politics, because certainly there is not just one of those, too.
Because it is social, it is almost necessarily political.
It is a social and public thing, and it cannot but have political vibrations. But there is the politics of the state. There are the politics of gender, for example,
right,
and of all kinds of other areas. So we would also have to make it a little clearer what dimensions of politics we're trying to get at in the case of any given text.
Stanley Fish, let me ask you to go back to the days of freshman English, specific and concrete. Can you name a writer, name a work, name a literary expression that will help us to understand these sort of blue abstractions that we're throwing around here about politics and language, gender, the way literary criticism and theory are coming to us in the 80s?
Well, I can, although it may just involve us in more abstractions. Mm-hmm. One of the things that we used to teach in English composition was to be clear, and I'm sure that in some ways that is still very much taught. And we were taught to be clear in the context of some linguistic concepts that were simply presented but not very much examined, like literal language or scientific or denotative meaning as opposed to connotative meaning, or metaphoric meaning versus straightforward meaning. One of the byproducts of theoretical thinking in the past 20 years has been to call into question each of these oppositions. To discover, for example, and this is particularly germane to the teaching of composition, that clarity, rather than being a property of some texts as opposed to others, is a function of political, social, institutional background circumstances within which things are clear for some people, that is, those who are thoroughly embedded in those circumstances, but are perhaps not clear for others and are perhaps heard as absolutely loony by others still.
Fred Jameson.
Well, let me give a more literary example. And, for example, I think the way Shakespeare is dealt with today, these texts, or romantic poetry or whatever, these texts, I think, were taught before as essentially philosophical, metaphysical, and also existential texts. That is, texts that had something to do with a vision of life, and perhaps also with certain kinds of subjective experience. Now, I'm not suggesting that they don't do that, but what we found that they also do is say something about the Elizabethan state, for example, Shakespeare, involve a whole set of ideologies of gender, if you like, and of relationships, in other words, to a whole set of other social areas. So very often, literary theory today is accused in one way or another of being reductive. It always seems to me that that's an odd reproach, since what we're really trying to do is expand the meanings
of
culture and connect these texts with a much wider variety of things than they ever were before.
Help me with the word interpretation. For instance, if we look at King Lear, which some critics, I guess, would say is one of the most magnificent texts, as you call them, in the English language. We read about daughters and father. We read about social and personal relationships. Why is it possible not simply to enjoy it or to learn from it, whatever, on those terms without necessarily moving it into the political? Because it's there already? Am I answering the question? Stanley, help me with that.
I think one answer is that that political terms, in the sense in which Fred was speaking, are always operative. Mm-hmm. That is, it is not the case that when we simply read King Lear as a story about fathers and daughters, or read Chaucer's Canterbury Tales as a reflection of medieval England, that we were then reading independently of political or social concerns. It's just that the assumptions about the relationship of literature to politics and society were already in place, and what they produced were the kinds of readings that we used to think were pure, that is, independent of those matters. It was just a different social and political emphasis. So I think we mustn't make the mistake, or at least I would say that we shouldn't make the mistake, of thinking that some readings are political and social, socially allied, and others are not. It's often a question of emphasis, what is foregrounded, what is not foregrounded.
Mm-hmm. Presupposing that there was what? One final way to read it?
No, presupposing really a distinction, a firm distinction, which I would just as firmly deny, between literary language and other kind of languages. Mm-hmm. The distinction being that ordinary conversational language is constrained toward a single meaning, while literary language has the property in and of itself of being productive of an infinite, almost infinite number of readers. Uh-huh. I don't think that's the case. I think that what was the case, that there was a program of literary reading, a kind of interpretive strategy that produced those kinds of texts by, in fact, training those kinds of readers. So I think that the level question is a bit... you can either ask the level, the attribution of many levels to a text can either be the product of a particular program, or it can be, in a sense, the record of the history uh-huh. of a succession of interpretations of texts by different programs, different interpretive programs directed in particular directions.
Well, one of the words that I hear amongst the literary theorists and critics, I want you to help me with this, Stanley Fish, Fred Jameson, is privileging, empowering kinds of language. At the same time, are we blurring the issues between what we used to call high and low art? If we are, to what end does all of this occur? Fred, Jameson?
Well, now you've asked several questions at once, so I think I'll have to separate those out. I think that to answer the last part first, I'm not sure we're blurring any boundary lines, because I think those are being blurred for us by the very development of American culture. But mm-hmm. But certainly we wish now to include much more systematically things that were thought of as either low culture or mass or popular culture. We think that those are very significant objects of study, and that you know, there are ways in which complex, high literary works cannot be fully understood unless you somehow connect them with the dynamics of those. So that's one very important area in which the very object of literary culture, literary and cultural study, has expanded in our time. Now, on the matter of privileging, I'd say two things. On the one hand, all interpretation does that. That is, when you talk about a movie afterwards, you say, what does it mean? Mm-hmm. And someone says, well, I think it's about violence or something. And then someone says, no, what it is really about is the couple relationship. So what you're doing is moving one area to the center and privileging it, which had not been apparent in the kind of immediate impressions that you were sorting out after this film or whatever. I think that's sort of what an interpretive act is, and it always means displacing a familiar kind of reading with a more unfamiliar one that makes the thing alive for you.
And that's going to make some people uncomfortable when we move, we shuffle these boxes around. Stanley Fish?
I wanted to pick up on something that Fred said, which I think is important. The distinction between low and high, and it allows us to go back to a point that had been made earlier. The distinction between low and high literary forms, if it's kept in place and never questioned, is supported by and supports in turn a whole set of social and political practices. And mm-hmm. you can see this easily, because if high literature, which was always attached, at least in the English tradition, to a particular class, both a social class and a ruling class, is thought of naturally as being the only important thing to study, then you have right there in that literary assumption a whole set of assumptions about the way history proceeds. A history of great men, mm-hmm. kings and ministers who make the important decisions, think the important thoughts, and then all of the other people, the masses, women, excluded people of various groups, and they have something called low culture,
right.
And therefore are in their cultural marginalization more or less put in exactly the same place that many mainstream histories put them in their political and social marginalization.
The essential lesson one wants to disengage from this variety of methods that we have to train our graduate students in is very much this one of, I don't want to say a relativism of interpretations, but at least of a multiplicity of possible interpretations. If an undergraduate suddenly realizes that when they confront something like Heart of Darkness or Catcher in the Rye or whatever, and imagine themselves seeing meanings in that object and simply reading those, what we want to show is, on the contrary, that they're reading one reading. Mm-hmm. And that there are other ones possible, and that this is not an object that simply possesses an interpretation that you extract, but that all kinds of different takes are possible, and that those have implications.
It's interesting you use the word takes. It I've been thinking about cinematic kinds mm-hmm. of things as you've been talking about these issues. Stanley Fish, let me give you a challenge you a bit. You teach an undergraduate course. You're going to teach, say, Moby Dick. Or The Scarlet Letter, or The House of the Seven Gables, or Huckleberry Finn, and an undergraduate comes in and says, I think that Huckleberry Finn is about nothing but money. How do you figure out how to guide an undergraduate sensibility through a book like Huckleberry Finn, the issues that it raises, and aim for some sort, what, of a consensus between you and the student about what is in the book? I almost use the word meaning, but I will back away from that.
No, don't ever back away from the word meaning. Actually, the question you've asked is quite an extraordinary one in some ways, because if 20 years ago someone had come in and said Huckleberry Finn is about money, the ordinary literature professor would probably have rejected it, not only as an absurd interpretation, but as one that violated the whole essence of literature and literary value, because it had been thought, and is still thought by many, that what makes a work of literature literature and what makes it valuable is precisely its concern with issues that transcend the everyday and especially transcend the mercantile. Uh-huh. One of the products of the kind of revolution, if that's not too dramatic a word, that Fred and I have been talking about, is the realization that literary works and the production of literary works is part of the economic marketplace, both the institutional economic marketplace and the larger economic marketplace, and that, therefore, to assert that a quote-unquote great work of American literature is about money is not today to make a horribly Philistine statement, but to indicate, especially if it came from the lips of an undergraduate, a kind of precocious awareness of new currents in literary study, where there are whole schools now of literary study which are looking at especially works of American literature as works bound up in economic disputes in 19th century America.
Fred Jameson.
Yes, Wayne, let me pick up this word consensus that you used. I think it is in my opinion a great mistake to imagine that our business is to reach some consensus with students about works. I don't think that that's an interesting thing to do. I think, on the contrary, one wants to train. When one talks about training students, one wants to train them in as many different possibilities of reading as one can. I said to the Huckleberry Finn student, I would enthusiastically urge her or him to try to work this up in as strong a fashion as possible, and then show that there are a number of other possibilities. I sometimes like to think of these very specialized interpretive languages and schools and programs that we have to deal with as so many foreign languages that one learns, and then in that case the point is not to pick one of them as the true one, yeah, and speak only that, but to translate from one to the other. Now, one can deplore specialization or not, but it's not going to go away. And I think the only way, if one has some ideal of some unification of things beyond specialization, that does not mean regressing to some simpler human estate before we got all these awful and complicated machine-like things, yeah, but going all the way through them. Mm. I think students today have a great deal more to learn than they had to learn 100 years ago in all fields. We know that. It is not surprising, therefore, to me that in the cultural literary area, the same should be true. And our students, therefore, have to do a great deal more work to go through these various specialized methods and learn to speak them, as I say.
Stanley Fish.
The resist. Fred, of course, is right. And I would add to that that the resistance to all of this new forms of talk doesn't come from students. Some of whom are coming out of the 10th and 11th grade.
Where does it come from?
It comes from, of course, faculty.
The old guard, so to speak?
Well, not even necessarily old in chronological terms. It comes quite understandably from people who have invested years in a certain kind of work, which they have always regarded in some ways as beyond challenge, and then see not only a number of challenges being made, but the spotlight and the excitement traveling in their direction. They become nervous and defensive, and also realize, the words of Thomas Kuhn, the historian of the philosophy of science, that they're going to have to retool.
Yeah.
Now, retooling is not an easy thing
read
to
some
do.
New and coming
books. Especially if you have to retool, as now seems the case, about every 18 months.
We're talking about privileging within privileging. Now, we're almost onto the area of academic squabbles. Let me bring us back to literature a little bit more directly. Fred Jameson, Stanley Fish. I'm not sure that it's a commonplace, but it's something of a currency in literary talk these days, that the critic is almost as important, if not more important, than the original expressive voice. How would you present these new critical theories, methods of approaching literature to graduates or undergraduates, indeed to general readers? Should they read, what, the stuff of literature itself or what's being done about literature? There's a distinction to be made there. Fred Jameson? Stanley Fish?
I would say no, there isn't, in some sense,
because
that distinction itself rests on an assumption that you can read a work of literature independently of any interpretive perspective within which to process it.
And that's called new criticism.
Therefore, you could read it without going to all of these critical perspectives. But I would say, and I've said at length in many pages, that any act of reading is always an act performed within some interpretive perspective, whether you're aware of it or not. So that the distinction between the stuff as it lies on the page and then the interpretive labors that might be performed on it will not finally hold up.
Mm-hmm. Fred Jameson?
Well, I think part of this challenge to the canon that's going on in all kinds of fields is raising the issue again of what the classics might be or whether we have such things or what the required readings are. I think one always has to think reflexively and critically about that. That is, realize that this is a historical issue, this matter of the canon, and that we're expanding it to include all kinds of new things. I myself hope that in the various projects for canons that we make up, it seems to me this must be an ongoing set of transformations, and that we will no longer end up with a fixed canon, but this will be in the process of constant modification, that in those we will read Joyce and Proust and Shakespeare just as much as study MTV and read contemporary things, or read women's literature, read third world literature, and read these so-called theoretical and philosophical texts. I don't think this canonical the curriculum that comes out of the canon should be in any way exclusive. It should involve the widest kind of reading experience possible.
Mm-hmm. How do the issues and concerns of your conference on literary criticism and theory, how do they connect at all directly to these issues of literacy that are in the headlines today? Fred Jameson?
Well, they certainly form the context in which this conference took place, and we found ourselves very much addressing the concerns of those books, although in very critical ways, because I think most of us feel that these are backward-looking and very traditionalist thoughts about how to solve the crisis of the universe. You see, I think there's if one takes an idealist position that education is somehow all powerful in its own right, then one can modify the educational system from within. Mm-hmm. If, on the other hand, one's sense is that education is part of the very social fabric, then suddenly these purely curricular solutions of going back to great books don't seem terribly helpful. I think we all feel that while we want to read those, there's a whole range of other so-called non-canonical things we want our students to read, and that we are not going to go back from the concerns of a whole range of contemporary theoretical and philosophical inquiries to Aristotle. It is that Aristotle is not the answer to all of our problems, mm-hmm. finally, today, and that these matters are much more complex.
Stanley Fish.
Yes. First, let me say that the conference, which was a wonderful success, was really organized and administered by Fred, and I was just one of the contributing cast. And he is, of course, right that the books by Bloom and Hirsch were very much mentioned during the course of the conference. I think that what both of these books want to do in different ways is either deny or refuse to look in the face the important factor of change, cultural change, change in ways of thinking, change in the entire set of materials which we process and which process us. So that Bloom's book, A Kind of Cry from the Heart, which could be summarized in a phrase like, why aren't things the way they used to be? Why don't my students love me as they once did? Why do they now listen to this music and not to the music that I know in my heart is better? Why is all of this happening? And what must we do to return the clock back to 1964, which I think was about his last good year? Whereas Hirsch, not wanting simply to go back, wants us to stop now. By setting up a list of 500 or 5,000 or 500,000, it doesn't matter, pieces of cultural information, which will be forever and ever, are pieces of cultural information, and we can pass them back and forth, more or less as the people who wore packs on their back in the third books of Gulliver's Travels passed items back and forth. Neither of these visions, what we might call nostalgias or desires, is going to make it, because they're looking, as I said at the beginning of my comment, they're not looking in the face of something that cannot be stopped, change. And the conference, among other things, was an attempt, first of all, to monitor the changes that have occurred, and then to try to take a look into the futures to see what new methods of adaptation, what new modes of pedagogy and intellectual and social action we can now develop to deal with a change that will not stop.
Stanley Fish and Frederick Jameson are professors at Duke University, where Stanley Fish chairs the Department of English and Frederick Jameson directs the graduate program in literature. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings on Theories of Literature is available on cassette. Ask for program number 388. Send $4 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. That's program number 388. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. When writing, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Next week on Soundings, conversations about modern American Southern culture. My guests will include Thaddeus Davis and John Shelton Reed of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Literature and Culture, this week on Soundings. Two prominent literary critics, Stanley Fish and Frederick Jameson of Duke University, discuss recent literary history, theory, and criticism. Convergence in Crisis, Literature, Politics, Ideology, and Art. Some answers and insights this week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station.